Welcome to Galaxy Brains. As always, I'm your host, Alex Thorne, head of firm-wide research at Galaxy. No rap intro this week, but we do have a great guest, Quinn Thompson, head of growth and capital markets at Maple Finance. He's going to join us to talk about markets and macro. He is a prolific writer about these markets as well as traditional markets, has some really interesting views, and we're going to get into what I'm now calling cycle theory when it comes to the Bitcoin markets, and is that a thing? And where are, if so, where are we in it? It's a fun conversation. Bibnet Abibi, our friend from Galaxy Trading, is off this week. We'll check up with him again next time. Before we get to that, I need to remind you to please refer to the link to the disclaimer in the podcast notes and note that none of the information in this podcast constitutes investment advice or an offer, recommendation, or solicitation by Galaxy Digital or any of its affiliates to buy or sell any securities. Let's hop right into the show. Let's go now to our guest, Quinn Thompson, head of capital markets at Maple Finance. Quinn, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Great to be here. Love stopping by, Alex.
Yeah, love having you on. We've been talking about markets on the internet. It reminds me of one of these things, and we met before, but it reminds me of, I don't know if you've heard the song by Joe Weisenthal's band, Light Sweet Crude, a great band, by the way, called All My Friends Are On My Phone. So that's one thing I love about doing this show live in New York is getting to hang out with people that, you know, we're terminally online human species, are we not?
Yeah, all day. And then the weekends, and then when you get in bed and you check,
And then I work on it all day online, talking to people online, and then I go home and look at my phone and talk online. It's getting rough. But anyway, great to have you in person. I've wanted to talk with Quinn for a while. We did an interesting joint podcast with our friend, our mutual friend, Ram Ahluwalia from Lumita Wealth, right before the Bitcoin ETF launches, and we were offering some predictions.
There's a lot of alpha in that one.
Yeah, we'll revisit that towards the end of the episode. But first, tell me about Maple Finance.
Yeah, so for the last 2 years, I've been leading growth and capital markets at Maple. We're a part of DeFi, but servicing the institutional part of the crypto market. So institutional lending, collateralized lending, similar to what like a Galaxy lending desk, you know, partner we work with, doing Bitcoin or ETH collateralized loans, providing yield for institutions, high net worth accredited investors in the crypto space. So, you know, we scaled to $1 billion last market, kind of with volumes came off, and recently kind of coming back over the 100 million mark. We're seeing activity pick up huge. You can imagine trading volumes, funding rates, the influx of stablecoins to the space. And the biggest launch we recently had last fall or late summer was Maple Direct. So we traditionally were an infrastructure provider for third parties to run their lending businesses on chain. And we saw a big opportunity with a lot of the industry kind of reset to launch our own lending business. And that's what Maple Direct is. So it's our direct lending arm, which myself and a couple others on the team have helped set up and start issuing loans from. And so it's all different types of collateralized lending to traders, institutions, and other lending desks in the space.
So when you talk about infrastructure for lending on-chain, for lending businesses or lenders to get their stuff, what does that mean, right? Because it sounds like you're sitting somewhere in between like CeFi and DeFi.
Yeah, exactly. So we're built on smart contracts. We are, you know, DeFi native. It started as a protocol on-chain. And some people call it, you know, the CeFi in the front, DeFi in the back, where, you know, we're using qualified custody to store the collateral that we hold from the borrowers. And it looks a lot like, you know, more like a centralized lending desk, but we're doing it transparently on chain via smart contracts. It optimizes a lot of the operational processes, adds efficiencies with reporting and accounting, administration like that. So you kind of get the best of both worlds where the lenders can see the transparency of what's underneath the loan book, which we know, you know, caused some issues last cycle, and they still interact with DeFi, but you know, it's regulated KYC institutional type of view.
I mean, that's pretty interesting because this has been a big question on our research team of if at all, or certainly when, traditional finance will start to care about DeFi. I sort of think of DeFi today as, well, there's a fair amount of on-chain wealth and it needs financial services, but and so it's clamoring for those services. And obviously when prices all go up, that's more wealth. So it's sort of a parallel financial system. I don't really hear anyone in traditional finance and markets demanding this technology be brought into, but this is an interesting example of how, you know, the transparency of public blockchains can provide some, you know, some genuine enhancement.
For sure. It's one of those you overestimate what you can do in 1 year, underestimate 10 years type of thing, because, and it's also how the RWA thesis in DeFi was born, which is, you know, traditional interest rates are inversely correlated with crypto DeFi interest rates, right? So typically, historically. And, you know, people were seeking those traditional yield vehicles on chain. And like you said, it's a slower transition getting the old system to adopt this new method. But I think what needs to happen is, you know, prove its worth and its use case with digital native assets, mm-hmm. you know, tokens, Bitcoin, ETH, Solana, et cetera, USD stablecoins. And then people see that optimization of their existing processes, and then they start to want to bring, you know, the industrial financing and all these other kind of more real world type of lending cases. On
yeah, it's like I was thinking also about something like proof of reserves, which is,
yeah.
I've argued this, I think, is maybe one of crypto's killer use cases.
You and Nick are
I am. I know.
Pioneers.
Dan gives me crap about this. My friend Dan Matuszewski, he's always trolling me about, like, nobody cares about this. I actually think it's one of the public blockchain's most potent use cases, like, because this is something that only cryptographic assets can do. So it's literally a step function improvement in transparency and safety quality over traditional assets. I mean, we're all just basically trusting that our brokerage firms and the DTCC like don't lose our securities or that they have them, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they're heavily regulated, which makes up for some of that lack of technical transparency. But you could even replace some of these rules with mathematical certainty, right?
For sure. I can't remember the year, but it was Citibank that fat fingered a $900 million loan. They're supposed to pay the interest to the lenders, and they accidentally fat fingered the whole loan amount. And there was this whole bankruptcy case basically for the company, and just like an administrative error that was extremely costly. There's a lot of cases like that where. The one thing I'm interested to see how it shakes out over time is, you know, like there's reasons to have some like non-transparency, right? Like, like banks, like how healthy, you know, but if you have to hide something, it's exactly.
Yeah.
So there's this balance, but like things like proof of reserves where you're not necessarily leaking IP, you know, like you're giving a more trusted audit. Is super valuable
right.
to know, like, who's the next, you know, SVB type of thing.
Right, and you could do this, obviously, in ways where, like, you don't reveal or you use zero knowledge or whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of those being...
But I can understand with Maple as a lender wanting to give... I mean, you need to prove the health and credit of you guys to your depositors or whomever else, right, to the counterparties that you work with.
Yeah.
It's quite an interesting, I think, just tie-up way of using DeFi and blockchain technologies in what is effectively a traditional lending business.
Yep.
I think that's interesting. But so let's move on. But you have told me, though, that you've been building this at Maple, but you are set to leave Maple.
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
That's right. So in May, I'll be launching a discretionary digital asset focus hedge fund called Lecker Capital, something I've been very interested in for a long time, investing personally back when I was in TradFi in fixed income, you know, coming at things from the macro angle. That's originally how I got into Bitcoin and crypto. And I think they're very intertwined and becoming increasingly intertwined with the ETF and things. And so I'll be launching in May, you know, traditional, macro fund, but focused on crypto and digital assets, doing things with traditional equities, crypto-related equities. I publish a lot on that stuff, and then as well as like tokens. So it's kind of how I manage my money, you know, trying to outperform Bitcoin in an uptrend and not take a 70% drawdown on a down.
Yeah, that's the challenge with this volatile market. I do like the idea of mixing the traditional assets and the cryptos. I mean, obviously now they're becoming more intertwined in markets, let alone the ETFs, but also there's a number of crypto-linked equities or whatever, whether... that's an interesting, there's opportunities there, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the tokens and things that exist in crypto, we're seeing a different, you know, and we're going to talk about later with the cycle and where we're at, the mechanism and transmission of flows is different this time with the ETF, I think, and where people have expected alts and things to run, it's kind of maybe stayed in some brokerages and gone to some of the miners or the Coinbases and the MSTRs. And so I think having that latitude to be able to play in different areas, and my background is traditional finance and coming from that, so like to pair the two, and that's how I think about the world.
Yeah, very interesting. Quinn's a good follow and publishes a lot of these thoughts on Twitter as well, or X, I should say.
I'm trying to learn after you.
I that's interesting. It's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And let's talk about markets now. I mean, it's you're a markets guy. Like I said, you have. You share a lot of commentary, which I always respect because, as I also do, and, you know, you can be wrong, and it takes you know, guts and confidence to share your views with the world. So I think that's always interesting. And it's a fun one to talk about. This is a very exciting market. It always has been. It was exciting at the depths of the last bear market, let alone at whatever it is we're dealing with now, which is certainly a it's something bullish. I think that's part of the debate we want to have a little bit.
Yep.
A lot of people have been asking me, like, for example, particularly with the upcoming Bitcoin halving, right? We have this historical idea that, you know, Bitcoin tends to enter these bull markets and, of course, ultimately the rest of crypto, which follows Bitcoin's lead, sometimes subsequent to the halving, right? We saw it in 2020, right? The halving was May 2020. We basically started, we re-broke prior December 2017 all-time highs in December 2020, and then, of course, went on a whole tear throughout 21. You saw the same thing in 2016, shortly after the halving, right? That's when 2017 happened. But this time, so people think that the halving has some causal relationship. I mean, there's also a big debate about whether it's correlation or causation. There's a bunch of other factors like global liquidity that may play a role. But leaving that aside, this time it's been different, right? We surpassed our 69,000 all-time high a week or two ago, even on a little bit of a dip that we're having at the time of our recording. Technically, we're $10 above the prior all-time high right now.
We need that to get to 69,420 by the end of this recording.
So the question is, and that people have been saying, well, is this... Okay, empirically, it is different. Yeah. It's the first time that we've retaken the prior all-time high prior to a halving. Does that mean anything? Does that mean that are we topping too early? I don't think any of – well, I'd like to hear your view. I've written about this. I say that, yeah, it's different, and that's okay. It can be different. But
yeah.
What's your take on where we are in the so-called cycle?
Yeah, I got – again, I come from the macro side of it. So I saw a lot of things lining up in September and October of last year, and then we obviously had that the ETF rumors kick things off. But today, when we got this like hot CPI – or inflation print today, reminded me of a tweet back in like September, October, where I said the best thing you can do if you're deep in crypto is forget about the 4-year cycles. I think they are going to exist in some respects, but I think it's going to be different because the ETF adds a lot of different things. One, it adds correlation. Sometimes it might be inversely correlated. I view Bitcoin as a 50% NASDAQ, 50% gold, and depending on the market regime, we trade more like either of them. Like, you know, recently NASDAQ's been very hot. Up until lately, gold was not, and Bitcoin was pumping pretty hard, more like tech stocks and AI. And but then you go to like October, where the NASDAQ was falling, and we had geopolitical conflict in Israel, and Bitcoin was rallying with gold. So it takes. It shape shifts, you know, it takes different forms. And I think it confuses people who don't look at it, you know, maybe more who look at it more from a crypto native lens. So I think it's going to be different. I do think the halving matters both, you know, obviously there's a supply effect and that just, you know, people get excited and it induces FOMO and things like right. that. But I also think that we are, as we've seen, beholden to the flows of the ETF, that cuts both ways to some degree. Now, look, if there's like, $20 billion of sovereign demand that's been pent up, ready to buy this thing, and they're TWAPing. You know, those guys don't buy overnight. And, you know, you have the situation where even when there's broader market volatility, Bitcoin just kind of either doesn't go down much or chops and it's fine. But I kind of think, you know, there's definitely some of the ETF money it's more fast money that at signs of like rising rates and things will probably hit the exit. So I do think it'll be different. I think we're later in what would people think of as the traditional 4-year cycle than expected. I actually would say, it's not talked about much, but you know, the kind of true-ish top was like the April Coinbase IPO, you know, so many things. And then we got this, the Bitcoin futures listing in the fall.
Yeah, a lot of people, the guys like Checkmate at Glassnode is a big proponent of this concept. And he says that on-chain data also shows that basically the November 21 high was like, not fake, but like wasn't retail, wasn't like it kind of like ran up on really, he argues it shouldn't really be counted as the really April 2021 is the sort of real high. And the fact that we got back to there basically is almost like was driven by something else, was driven by a small amount of like, influential big traders, wasn't a retail like mania was one of the interesting things to look at on this is literally like on-chain transaction volumes and stuff.
Down only from the spring.
Right,
yeah,
right. Exactly. So I hear you. It's an interesting point.
So it was a longer bear or like an earlier start to the bear than people think. Probably people mentally attribute the start of the bear to like Luna kind of thing. But
which is as late as like, what, April or May 22. Yeah, that's much later.
Yeah, wait.
Like a whole year after
that. Macro had already peaked, well, you know.
Yeah.
So I think we're like 2-3 weeks ago, I thought we were, you know, we might hit this, you know, parabola. We've kind of hit it a little bit. We crossed highs. I thought we would have got a little higher, but I think we might cool off here. And I think it's like a little relief kind of early 21.
So I think healthy. We're
late, but it should go longer, right? Like we have the ETF now. So there's an implicit stronger bid. So it's going to look different.
Yeah.
But we are later, I think, than people give credit.
That's interesting. Yeah. Especially if you adjust the start time of the cycle or whatever. I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you're right. So December 2020, we get back to 20 or so. And then we did chop a little bit. I mean, you know, bullish months, I think the most bullish month, if I recall, is maybe February of that year. We really ran pretty hard. And then we go higher and then... I don't know, what was the actual top in April 21? Was that when Elon rugged on payments at Tesla? Do you remember?
It was. He was on SNL with Doge.
Yeah.
And that was I remember I was in between
jobs. That was
jobs.
The 69 cent top in Doge.
Yeah. And he was on SNL, literally peaked during that. I remember that was hilarious.
Yeah.
It was the Coinbase IPO. It was MicroStrategy's ripped off two converts. It very, you know, not 2 weeks. I think it was a month. Something like that. But the last one was Feb, I think, 21. Mm-hmm. Similar. Coinbase just did a stock offering. MSTR just got off two converts. Meme coins. I mean, like, let's be honest. I love them. I, you know, for a couple weekends, you know, you're trading them. But they are what they are. And they're like the attention, you know, you're fighting for housefly attention spans here. And they can't go on forever. So there's a lot of signs. Like I said, I don't think it's like this Pico top or anything. But... you know, particularly if macro starts weakening here, higher rates, it's vulnerable.
Yeah, and the inflation data does look like it's kind of going the wrong way at the moment. It's not, like, drastic, but it's not cooling, right? I mean, if they're looking for signs of continued reduction in the inflation metrics, they're not currently getting those signs.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the risk. I mean,
creates risk for risk assets.
It's the election year, so I actually, you know, in one of these camps where it's like, How do Powell and Yellen and people in power keep the power? It's with a strong market. So, you know, dips, I think, will still be bought this year. But they have these little, like, fires they have to put out when rates spike. The thing to watch, too, you have here is oil and commodities. Copper looks like it's breaking out. And I think that's what gold's responding to a little bit is where, you know, they know the Fed eventually will find a way to kind of keep a lid on rates. And that suppresses real yields and sends things like Bitcoin and things higher. So... I'm very constructive on a medium term.
Yeah.
This is more tactical.
I hear you. I think it makes sense. And look, I mean, it's been, I mean, Bitcoin was up, I think, from what, 38.5, and we were up 60-70% in like a month.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the last like 50 days of Bitcoin price, it's effectively up only. Like,
you gotta zoom out a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I think in general it's obviously healthy if we don't want a parabolic top here. I mean,
if
you want to go higher, right?
Yep.
There's only, I guess, that first cycle, if we've encountered as one in like 2013, there were sort of two peaks, but I mean like that where one went much higher or the second one.
Such
but
a small asset.
It's not healthy. Yeah. Like parabolic manias are not healthy. Like we'd like to go, you know, like staircase up, staircase down, not elevator up. Or usually it's staircase up, elevator down.
Yeah.
But you'd like, let's be more. And I agree. Let's talk about the meme coin mania, as I think Bloomberg called it, a mania. There was a Bloomberg segment. And I, you know, I was talking with Anthony Pompliano. He told me that at the time when I spoke to him, which was like maybe around like March 13th or that it was that there were 2,500 meme coins being launched per hour on Solana.
Yep. Feed the ducks when they're quacking.
Yeah, that seems like a bit of a local top signal. I mean, how many of these derivative jokes can you make? We already have like 5 or 10 like relatively well-valued dog-themed coins. Then there's all these political ones. I don't want to name these ones, but they're funny names. I'm certainly not trying to like actually promote them in any way. But you have one or two that came out. Now there's like every single probably member of Congress has the one. I'm making this up. I don't know. But like there's tons of them. And it's like that feels local toppy to me, if not totally toppy. But with our long, medium, and long-term constructive view on Bitcoin in general, driving that market. I'm not prepared to say total top in meme coins, but it feels like we're at a point where it's like, I mean, how much more juice is in this lemon?
Yeah, it's an attention game you're really fighting for. You know, in these markets, those bouts of strength can last longer where you have stablecoin supply growing a couple billion a week. So we've, since the start of the year, we've had stablecoins growing like 15 billion year to date. I mean, that's huge on like 130 billion base. Mm-hmm. It's like 2% a week. So, you know, you get new entrants, retail's coming back. And it, I think, yeah, like it just goes to, we're a little later than people ascribe in the cycle. But again, like everything's very healthy overall, I think.
Right.
Like you're seeing actual, you know, more adoption. Like that's what the ETF is showing. There's more adoption coming in. So,
yeah. I think your point about earlier that the cycle can also be longer.
Yeah.
And again, I think we agree. It already looks different. It's probably going to keep looking different. One of the things that we've been talking about, like we had estimated in October in our report about the ETFs this was a methodology. They're going to make
it. It was very good.
We said $15 billion. I appreciate that. Thank you. And we said $15 billion of net inflows into the ETFs in year one, which could result in a price of around $75,000. That's basically happened in the first 2 months, both the price and the inflows, the net inflows. But the thing is about our report, we didn't even bother to look at any type of retail interest. The entire estimate is predicated on the idea that it's advisors and wealth managers who don't have currently access to put their end clients into Bitcoin exposure. Because we said, you know, just on balance, like retail, like me and you, we can buy Bitcoin in a variety of places, have been able to for years. And by the way, the most sophisticated investors, endowments and pensions, should they want exposure, well, they can sign a private placement agreement. But you can't, as a financial advisor, do 150 private placements for your thing. Or if you're on a platform at a bank or broker dealer, they mostly haven't allowed this.
Yep.
So they were the net new accessible market. But we've now gotten to where we said, and it was a conservative estimate, that market could take the ETFs and the Bitcoin price without them. They're still not actually really here. The banks and broker dealers, some of them may be offering on an unsolicited basis. But so that to me is quite bullish because you'll see them turn on over the next 3 to 24 months. So you'll constantly have these unlocks of new potential investors. But that also changes the glide path here.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Those haven't, there's no way those have come. And I know you guys have been really active with your ETF with Invesco as well. So you're probably pretty plugged in. I mean, I think also like there's just a bunch of young people that like, they're like, I don't want to own General Motors and Hershey and my money in my retirement. I can't touch for 40 years. I'll just like YOLO into Bitcoin, which is probably like decently smart. Like, so there's no one can put a finger on where the capital's from. I've heard, you know, rumors about big, you know, buyers that have maybe seeded ETFs and things. But like you said, like we're seeing these like filings trickle where it's like the Morgan Stanley funds and then the BlackRock other funds are starting to add it to their allowed invest list. And it's just going to continue, which I think makes this cycle really different.
One thing that's going to be really exciting is in April when we start to see the 13F filings for these funds, right? Certain classes, I don't think individual retail necessarily.
But it's on like Druck and PJT's like
And that won't surprise too much. No. Those guys are bullish, but who knows what we might find on there. These are filings where large holders of equities have to disclose that they hold them. And so I don't know. Like, trust me, we're going to be looking as soon as those probably come out in like the second or third week of April after quarter close in Q1. And it'll be really interesting to see who has filed to say they own the Bitcoin ETFs. And I'm sure there will be a couple surprises there.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get bearish on this, particularly Bitcoin. We could talk like alts and things like that don't have this ETF driver. It's a different story. There's some like really high FDV coins that are doing the old playbook that I don't think is going to work this time. Like, you know, last cycle was like every single asset on earth went straight up and indiscriminately, even coins that it's just like a lot of things didn't make sense. So I think it's going to look different from that regard. Like people are expecting like the shittiest of shit coins will just go up forever. And that probably doesn't happen. There has to be some logic there. But you look at like who's already bought Bitcoin, right? Like there's a number of public companies besides MSTR, like Reddit, you know, that's kind of kicking off this wave, right? People are seeing what MSTR is doing. All they've done to build this business is buy Bitcoin. That's it. And then the market takes it from there. It increases the vol. There's speculation. They can issue converts. They issue the converts and they add book value to their business. The stock is worth more. It commands a premium. It's like Saylor's just so genius. But if you're like some like you know, middle market, you know, loud, like sleepy public company. It's like, shit, should we just do that? Like, why can't we? Let's go raise some money. Or, you know, sovereigns, right? We had that meeting with, where we have the El Salvador guy who's like, you know, huge advocate. He's meeting with like Middle Eastern leaders and sovereigns.
I saw this, Nayib Bukele. What's he doing over there?
Yeah, yeah.
I bet he's mentioned Bitcoin. And I'm then certain he has. Well, I can't be certain, but you have, one has to assume.
I mean, come on. Yeah, like, yeah. You know, and then you have the sovereign wealth funds like, you know, the Singapore, like Temasek and some of those were involved last cycle.
NVC and yeah. stuff, and yeah.
So, like, it's literally happening, and these signs are there, and the ETF makes it more accessible and more. I haven't had as many, like, normies, like, just reaching out, like, hey, what?
Yeah, we're not really fully there. I've had a couple.
But I've had people.
There were basically none until a month ago. Yeah. And then just a few.
But people are more, like, accepting than they're like, all right, you guys just, like, battled, like, some. Like, that was a messed up.
You walked through the fire, yeah. sir.
So yes. They're like, all right, there must be something here. And it just happens every cycle.
Because so many people came in the last cycle with such an explosion of normal and retail awareness, just awareness, even whether or not they got interested or bought Bitcoin, like such a huge base of people. And then maybe that was their first time. And then it goes down to, I mean, Bitcoin ultimately goes, I think bottoms around 16.5 or 16.3. And that's a huge drop from 69K. And, you know, maybe some of them are like, oh, it's dead. This is the first time. Some of us have been in the market a long time. This has happened a couple times. Yeah. So like we're kind of like dead to that.
Yeah.
Like,
super. It's not mean, even, yeah.
And I believe long enough term in Bitcoin generally that like, you know, I mean, frankly, most long-term Bitcoiners are kind of upset. They want to stack more sats at lower prices. But this might be the first time that they've seen us be declared completely dead on arrival.
Every headline.
Every headline, literally. Even some believers. You remember, what was his name, Paul Graham? Or like, I mean, people
threw in the towel.
It's just crazy, some of the stuff we saw. Jim Cramer's called it dead like 35 times, been wrong.
The fund that pivoted to AI.
Yeah.
And then pivoted back.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, so, but now those people have seen like, wait, because there's something that looks different, right? Tulip mania, if it even happened at all. Didn't happen twice, didn't happen a third time.
Yeah.
It didn't keep coming back.
Yeah.
So there's obviously something here. And I think, you know, sort of average folks who aren't like diehard into crypto or have been to Bitcoin, we know it, but they're seeing it now. I agree. And for that signal in your mind, like, you know, the every single person pinging you, wait a sec, how do I buy Bitcoin? That hasn't happened.
No. And I think naturally the cycles should get shorter. Like that's why ultimately 4-year cycles will go away, I think is now there's many factors, but the reaction function should speed up. It's like how many times do you have to watch something go up 10x and down and not die, 10x, down, not die, to be like, all right, that's like clearly there's something here.
Yeah.
So every time more eyeballs, more adoption. And so that's going to shorten the response time for people like, oh,
Bitcoin's, dips get bought sooner.
Yeah,
like
Bitcoin's, you know, oh, Bitcoin's rallying again. I should get in before I buy the top. So there's that, but there's also this, what I would say within, so that's outside of crypto. Within crypto, there's bear market trauma. This was a bad bear market.
That's true.
This was a deep bear market. So you've had people every step of the way from October when the run started in the 20s to today in the 70s, like frantic, you know.
Yeah.
You know, how many tweets do you see of like, what's your top signal list? What's your top?
I know.
And that just tells me there's no top because you don't get that when people are when you're at the top. Then it's super cycle talk.
The top is like euphoria and stuff like that. Like no, people are pretty shell-shocked, I agree.
So it's like, it's these two combating factors, which again, why I think it'll be, you know, stairs, more stair-like and longer and different.
Yeah, it's got and then one of the other ideas that I want to raise this one with you, I've been criticized by some of my friends for this idea, which is great. I love, that's makes a fun idea.
Yeah, makes markets.
In addition to the fact that like the ETFs are not being turned on yet on all these platforms where there's all this wealth that can't get exposure, and that may be prolonging or certainly being bullish that they're not here yet. There's a question, I also think, particularly if it's in advisor-managed accounts, that capital is stickier that you put into Bitcoin. It's not on a crypto exchange where it can be easily. So that has two things that it tells me. One, advisor manager accounts will have a portfolio target. If Bitcoin goes above its their percent. They'll probably sell some. If it goes below, they'll come buy back. That should reduce volatility, which is long-term good. But the other idea is that what if this intra-crypto rotation trade that we've seen so many times, right? Bitcoin all-time high in December 17, ETH all-time high in January 18, alt season in March, right? And then everything goes down. Like, and we've seen it at the cycle level. Like, we've seen it in little microcosms during bull markets. If Bitcoin goes sideways, like in November and December, it's kind of sideways a little bit. Then you saw like an alt season happen, but shouldn't the stickiness, if an increasing share of Bitcoin is held in market access vehicles, especially if it's in lots of advisor managed accounts, although basically almost none of it is yet, but shouldn't that also dampen the intra-crypto rotation trade because that is stickier capital? It's not there to flow from I don't think advisors are likely to be like, oh my God, wait a sec, let's call the top here and then rotate into ETH and let's rotate into Solana, right? I mean, what are your thoughts on this idea?
Imagine, right? The the Edward Jones guy in Detroit's again, this is another point I kind of go back and forth. I'm a big Coinbase bull. And then I also look back at last cycle and I did some math. And, you look at Grayscale Trust, we're a big accumulator of vehicles. There's obviously private funds like the ones you guys have that brought assets in. But GBTC added about $6.5 billion of flows last cycle. And this is impactful on much smaller market cap. ETH added about $1.5 billion, but stablecoins added $130 billion whatever.
So it went from basically one at the end of 2017.
Yeah. So every dollar into these regulated more TradFi vehicles is a multiplier into stablecoins. But those are later flows. Stablecoins peaked in April 22. They're later. It has to get going. Venture funding isn't peaking yet because people do that after the FOMO's hit. So it's been a delay. I still think that happens. Come on, it's going to happen. Everybody you talk to is oh, wow, Bitcoin's great. But I've heard that Solana and ETH, they're the better block, you have that net. It's just human nature and it's just slower. And this Bitcoin Dom run has been an absolute beast from basically the merge in September of 22 or whatever to today. And it's thrown people for a loop. And you've had pockets like the memes, different trades around Catalyst, the Solana Catalyst, the Bitcoin Eco Catalyst. And you're still getting those. It's just not a cover and everything's up. And
it literally was obviously you remember this in 21. It was there's what they call the Sol Luna AVAX trade. Yeah. It was literally which alt L1 hasn't run yet? Just throwing the dart and the market was hunting for those things.
I mean, you had the Tungsten Cube thing. I could have paid for my car with the Tungsten Cube, which by the way, I round tripped obviously. And then that was the only money I had on FTX. I was trying to sell that thing. And I had it on the. Yeah,
here's ours right
I
here.
I didn't get it, and I totally forgot.
Well, what about that big one? Nick's always talking about this on the Brink. That big, they had it. How big was it? A foot?
Yeah, dude,
a little bigger.
It's like a ton or something.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Supposedly, it was in the lobby of the FTX office in Bahamas. I haven't seen this in the bankruptcy.
Well, they have mine too.
It's crazy. Another counter argument that I've thought about to my point about the dampening. Notice I'm using the word dampening. I'm certainly not saying there won't be rotations in crypto world, but and obviously I'm using the word dampening, which is an extremely vague word that I'm not gonna qualify with any data because I'm really not even sure how to qualify it. So it's a sense and it's a theory, but another thing that counteracts it is the idea that, not all of the rotation is actual capital rotation.
Right.
It can be wealth effect. It can be, a lot of people that own alternative crypto assets, they may also own Bitcoin. And so they're wealthier when Bitcoin goes up. Or they just see it in the market and they say, you know what? I'm increasing my offers. Right? Prices just go up because people are like, if Bitcoin's worth 75K, then XYZ alt should be worth this, which is higher than before. And it just still kind of happens in terms of price action. It doesn't need to be capital rotation.
Another area I don't hear people talk about enough is last cycle was by far and away the biggest venture-backed investing boom in the industry's seen. We had ICOs in 17, but that's crowdfunding. And this was Andreessen's pouring in, you know, billions. We got it, and
I mean, 21 and 22 by my count was basically like almost 65 billion invested in startups.
And so the problem is all those guys need liquidity, and there's no, but no M&A, there's no IPOs. And how do you do it? You do a token, and we're seeing that. And there, a lot of them are trying this, you know, old, SBF, you know, initiated game of low float, high FTV. And there's still that overhang where price for these can stay the same and market cap can go up because the inflation supply is huge. And that's a problem for a lot of these that, and it's an attention game, and that's where you get these rotations. So you still have it. On the volatility point, we talked about this on the pod, you know, was it a sell the news thing? And secularly, for sure, it's going to lower volatility. We're not, you know, we might see 70% dip again, but it's not going to be the norm with this bid. And so that's on a secular multi-year horizon where people are like, oh, dude, like, you're an idiot. You said vol's going to dampen. And it's like, well, we're entering a bull market where volatility is cyclically rising. I think volatility is cyclically too cheap on like a 3, 6, 12 month basis, probably continues to rise. So like, you can have these different views. That's where I find most disagreement is on time horizon.
What's the most fun part about these markets? Yeah. And these are just the most exciting markets.
It's so
fun. I mean, there's, because you're coupling like big, giant, serious stories like Bitcoin, like decentralized non-sovereign FX, you know, that with a fixed supply and, you know, credible neutrality and transparency that also has huge implications for things like human liberty and human rights. On one end.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Then you've got things like, you know, dog tokens that have intentionally no utility at all. And by the way, there's a bunch of other interesting stuff all in the middle. I don't know, is that, to me, that's sort of the other end of the barbell.
Yeah.
And so it's a wild, crazy, technologically brilliant, but also like socially mimetic kind of market, which is just so fun. I mean, that's what drives.
I was arguing about 25 basis points on like, you know, bond and loan deals and TradFi for, you know, fine tooth combing every legal doc for years. And I was like, and then I found crypto and I was like, yeah, this is sick.
I think that's what happens, especially like people that do volatility trading. Yeah. You see a lot of commodities trading. You see fixed income people that do rates.
Yeah.
A lot of people really like the story here. But again, it's such a diverse, broad story. Mm-hmm. I still think, you know, Bitcoin, even just if it was the only one, is a big enough story. Like,
for sure.
But there are others, and that makes it exciting. And there's new technology still being built. Like, and whether it's blockchain technology or new ways of thinking about blockchains, you know, some of the stuff we haven't talked about that people are talking a lot about is restaking and modularity. And you mentioned the Bitcoin eco, right? We're seeing the launch of ZK rollups that will settle on Bitcoin, which is super interesting. So there's more to the story than even the market. The technology story is still big.
Yeah,
like, we shouldn't bet against human ingenuity, but sometimes I do wonder, like, wait a sec, haven't we like figured this out yet? And it's like, well, some genius came along with some new idea.
Yeah, it's just like unseen, like anything before. I mean, how I look at it, and this is my macro hat again, is it's an emerging market. It's you know, when there's a gold boom in the east, in the west coast of the U.S., when there's a boom in China and a boom in India, and capital floods in. And there's such high demand for funding, interest rates rise, that eventually causes the demise because, you know, capital gets too costly and it kind of, you know, hampers innovation. I see it as an emerging market, and you have Bitcoin, which is kind of like your store value, your gold. You have these are more like tech, you know, innovations. And it's really a lot of the tokens are like early stage venture where, you know, like one day it looks like it's, you know, the life-saving thing. And the next day, you know, there's just... The future value could be a trillion or zero. So the vol in between is just like, it's what makes the markets what they are. And there's no fun, no more other place you'd rather be.
Quinn, before we wrap, tell the audience where to find you and where to follow you.
Yeah, absolutely. Twitter, active there, going back and forth. You know, I have a Substack. You can read some of my stuff there and reach out. Always like chatting with smart people.
Quinn Thompson, I guess former head of capital markets and growth at Maple Finance. Thanks for coming to Galaxy Brains.
Yeah, appreciate it.
That's it for this week's episode of Galaxy Brains. Thank you to our guest, Quinn Thompson, now former head of growth and capital markets at Maple Finance. Everyone have a safe and happy weekend, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. If you enjoy the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To follow Galaxy Research, sign up for our weekly newsletter at gdr.email, read our content at galaxy.com/research, and follow us on Twitter at GLXY Research. See you next week.